Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, chapter 26. This is text 19. Santvayan shlakshnaya vacha hridayena viduyata priyasya sneha sangramba lingam atmani nabhyagat. Translation. The king, with a grieved mind, began to speak to his wife with very pleasing words. Although he was filled with regret and tried to pacify her, he could not see any symptom of anger caused by love within the heart of his beloved wife. Please repeat. The king, with a grieved mind, began to speak to his wife with very pleasing words. Although he was filled with regret and tried to pacify her, he could not see any symptom of anger caused by love within the heart of his beloved wife. So this is a very interesting translation. What on earth is a symptom of anger caused by love? What could it be? Let's hear from Srila Prabhupada. See if it's revealed in this purport. The king very much regretted having left his queen and having gone to the forest to execute sinful activities. When a person regrets his sinful activities, the abandoning of Krishna consciousness and good intelligence, his path of deliverance from the path of material clutches is opened, as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 5.5.5. Prabhavas tavad abodajato yavanna jigyasata atmatatvam. When a person loses his Krishna consciousness and loses interest in self-realization, he must engage in sinful activities. All one's activities in a life devoid of Krishna consciousness simply lead to defeat and misuse of one's life. Naturally, one who comes to Krishna consciousness regrets his previous sinful activities in the human form. Only by this process can one be delivered from the clutches of nescience or ignorance in materialistic life. Oma jnana timirandasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshuram militang jena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manobhishtam stapitam jena bhutale svayam rupa kadamayam dadati svapadantikam. So it does not seem as if the mystery is going to be solved in this particular verse. And I was very much interested, having only just discovered this verse 5 minutes before I sat on this highly elevated seat to speak to you. So can anybody enlighten me? What is a symptom of anger caused by love? If you love someone, how can you get angry with them?
I'm not sure what it is, but I remember when Krishna was talking to the
demon. Yes.
He wanted to arouse a similar reaction.
Yes. And what was Krishna trying to do when he talked to Rukmini, though? He wanted to see her angry. But what's happening in this verse? She's angry, isn't she? She's so angry that she's beside herself with angry. No jewelry, hair all over the place, lying on the floor. She's really distressed. Something's really made her distressed. Okay. I think the women here think that you are not expert in the ways of love. They have rejected your proposal. Who knows? I don't know. I'm also not an expert. Shankaracharya was not an expert also. What happened to him? Shankaracharya, he was undefeated in his argumentation. And so they said the only way to defeat him is if we start an argument with him. This is what you do with a philosopher. You start an argument with him based on erotic principles, something that he knows nothing about, and it will be very easy to defeat him. So we'll talk about mundane love and physical intimacy between men and women. He knows nothing of these things. And then we'll be able to defeat him in our highly skilled argument. So Shankaracharya, his reply, you know what his reply was? He went, yes, wait. He went deep into meditation, wait. He said, just wait, I'll be with you in 3 days. I will have all the answers for you. So he went deep into meditation. And he went astral traveling. Shankaracharya's soul left the body, and he found the body of a king who was just about to die, or who had just died, but had not yet been cremated. And from the king's memory bank in his brain, the soul of Shankaracharya was able to pull out all the memories of physically intimate episodes and erotic episodes, until he became an expert. See, it's just like a memory stick. Yeah. He downloaded everything from the king's memory. Who knows how many gigabytes of erotic episodes were there? How much pornography was actually there in the king's brain? With 16, 24, 32 wives. How much a king enjoys. But then he dies, and then is born as a beggar. This is a very sad thing. And so Shankaracharya, he was, you know, a few gigabytes extra now. And he came and he sat before them and he gave a brilliant exposition. And they said, how do you know that? You see, how do you know that? He said, one who knows Brahman, it knows everything. And so I'm afraid I haven't done that, but I can hazard a guess. But neither am I requested to hazard a guess here. But we should simply take it as it is, that he could not see any symptom of anger caused by love. That in loving dealings, sometimes different contrary emotions are displayed. Someone loves someone, but they have been spurned. They're deeply in love with someone, but they have to show how unhappy they are to have been left. You left me all on my own. Why did you do that? The famous scenario is the girl left waiting in the cafe, or the girl left waiting outside the cinema or the theater or some club, and she texts him or phones him the next day. You left me. You left me standing there. How dare you? How could you? She still loves him, but she has to show the anger. And then, of course, if he's a smart man, he will then have to be very, very regretful and contrite. And along with the contriteness, the contrition, should come a gift of suitable size. You see, because for everything that you do wrong, when you say that you love someone, there should be a suitable gift as recompense, you see. If I love my country, but I don't obey the laws of the country, I'm sorry, then you have to pay a suitable price, you see. You see. It's just like I say, I love going to Ireland. I was on holiday in Ireland, brief holiday, very brief. But I was caught by a speed camera. I so much loved Ireland that I was driving too fast. All it took was just a little second. And the demigoddess, the goddess of Ireland, the personification of everything that is Irish, I was punished by her through the agency of the police force, the Garda Síochán. Please send €80 within the month. You must pay for not following the rules. You see, forgiveness is important, but justice is also important. If you're always forgiven, always forgiven, always forgiven, your character never develops, and you never develop an understanding of the right balance of law within the universe, or within the family, or within the marriage, or within the temple, or within the state. Forgiveness is important, but one who forgives is not doing justice to that person. Therefore, in the Bible it is said, spare the rod and what? Spare the stick and spoil the child. Yes, I don't know what our ISKCON Child Protection Office would say about that, but Mother Yashoda certainly didn't hesitate to pick up a stick. Of course, she never ever struck Krishna, but in her love to bring Krishna up properly, she chased him with a stick. And Krishna was actually very, very fearful. This story, actually, of how God is chased by his mother with a stick in the name of Dharma, how the person who is the origin of all Dharma is chased by someone who wants to instill Dharma into them, or how Arjuna, the very servant of Krishna who loves Krishna so much, is giving orders to Krishna for 18 days. Krishna, go here. Krishna, turn left. Turn right. You know, go over there. Go faster. He's ordering Krishna. These two stories have been enough to send thousands of years worth of Vaishnava acharyas into ecstasy. Nam Alwar was in ecstasy. And he fell into ecstasy for many, many days, just contemplating Mother Yashoda chasing Krishna with a stick. And we also fall into ecstasy every Kartik for at least a month. This story captivates us so much. It's the only story about Krishna that we read every day for a month. Have you ever wondered why? You ever wonder why? It's the most ecstatic story, isn't it? So Nam Alwar says he goes and he can't even speak. Nam Alwar was born, and as soon as he was born, he was taken to a temple. Of course, Nishkramanam after 10 days. But then his parents received a message from the deities. Isn't it nice? You know, you come in front of the deities and you receive a message. Radha Gopinath speaks to you. Wouldn't that be nice? Just one little word, please. One day, one wet Tuesday when the sky is grey, and there's just a little shaft of sunlight and it falls on my face and Radha Gopinath speaks to me. That would be enough for my whole life. Does it ever happen? We can pray for that to happen. A little ray came from the deity in this particular town, and the mother and father were told to leave your son here at the temple. So like in the Bible, you know, Isaac was taken out by his father and God said, kill your son. Don't think it's just in the Bible that these things are there. Jamadagni, it was also there. You know, cut the head off. And of course, he had great faith. He did it and the head was put back on. Isaac was saved. And similarly, this baby was subject to, the parents were subject to the test of God. And the baby just lay there, and the local villagers and the parents fed the baby, and the baby didn't say anything at all until he was 16. Like Shukadev Goswami didn't speak till he was 16. And he only spoke because someone who was the right person, like Maharaj Parikshit, was the right person to hear from him, actually came in front of him. And way up north, this was way down south, way up north was another of the Alwars. His name was Madhura Kavi. And Madhura Kavi was on pilgrimage. And the Alwars have, there's 108 places of pilgrimage that they say that the Vaishnavs should try to get to. 106 you should try to get to in this life, and then another two after you leave this life. They're in Svetadvipa and Vaikuntha. So in the north there's Badarik Ashram and Ayodhya and Mathura and Vrindavan. But most of the others are in the south. So he was on pilgrimage and it just so happened that he'd reached Vrindavan. And he looked, this is Madhura Kavi. And Madhura Kavi looked up into the sky and he saw a light off in the distance. And with the light came the voice, as it often does in these stories. and he had to return south. It was the voice that said, seek out who is under the light. So he went all the way back, and it's no small journey to go from the north of India down to the south of India. It's a very long way, especially when you have to walk. So he walked, and then he came to this town where the light was shining above the head of Namalwar. And then he began to recite poetry to try to bring him out of his trance, because he just knew that he had something to tell him. And when he opened his eyes and came out of trance, he was speaking stories of Krishna. And this was at least around, minimum, this is around the year 900. So this is before Ramanuja, before Madhva, before Lord Chaitanya. So he starts speaking about Krishna and the love of the gopis for Krishna. So it's important to understand that the love of the gopis for Krishna is not something that is only our exclusive preserve. It is distributed by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but it has been there from the very beginning, of course, and we find it in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So when we hear Gopi Bhartu Parakamalayora Dasa Dasa Nudasa, this is the best of all four Vaishnava Sampradayas, what Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is giving. So then he came to the story of Mother Yashoda chasing Krishna with a stick, and he just went back into his trance. He couldn't continue. He was in too much ecstasy. So, alright, well, that was a little deviation. Where were we? Stick, yes. So, anyway, I forgot where I was. So the king here, he's trying to exercise pacification. He's trying to, he knows that she loves him, but she's very angry with him, and she's showing her anger, so he's very contrite. He doesn't have any hunting trophies. We don't read that he's coming back with a nice deer that he's killed, or a wild boar or something to offer to her. You know, I only went hunting for you, my love. Look, I killed this deer and I brought it back for you. I don't know, maybe princesses are into deers. Sita should certainly, you know, she asked Ram, please catch him. You see, maybe there's something going on there, that the husband shows his prowess in hunting, and the queen, she enjoys seeing her husband big and strong, and his foot is on the tiger. Maybe that's what princesses, you know. I don't know. Maybe some women like to have their... So anyway, now he's very contrite, and he's coming, and he's... In the next verse, it says that he touches her feet. He touches her feet, and he embraces her, and he's speaking very sweetly. And it says here in text 20, which I've also got to do tomorrow, he says, because he was very expert in flattery, he began to pacify her very slowly. Very slowly. She's very angry. But when someone's very angry with you, you speak slowly to them. You ever tried apologizing to someone? No, I didn't really mean it, because it wasn't my fault. It was someone else. And then what happened was, oh, shush. I don't want to hear your excuses. I don't want to hear your reasons. What's actually going on? I just want you to know that I'm angry. And I want you to sit and listen while I explain to you exactly how angry I am. There needs to be an emotional release. So the king is very, very slowly, he's allowing this emotional release to come. And then he's going to allow his queen to manifest her. Because you see, anger is something that must be discharged. Prabhupada said, when anger is conceived within the mind over something, we know, dhyayato vishayam pumsam. First there's contemplation on the ideal state. This is what should have happened. And oh dear, this is what did happen. Okay? Then there's frustration. Then there's anger. Then Prabhupada said, anger then pollutes the entire system. It pollutes the body. Anger actually goes into the bloodstream. And then it must be discharged. It must come out. You see? And often you have a person there's no way to discharge the anger, what happens? They discharge the anger by punching something or kicking a table or shouting at someone who's done nothing wrong, isn't it? So anger pollutes the system and it has to be discharged. It's like sometimes we have bad wind here. You have to get rid of it. Or you've eaten something. Okay? You have to... That was a belch, by the way. That was meant to be a burp. What's that in Belgian? Flemish? Boer. Okay. So, what goes in that shouldn't be there, excess wind shouldn't be there. It has to come out. So excess anger, that also has to come out. It has to find some way of being discharged. Now, later on in the Bhagavatam, we find that sometimes a man bites the inside of his mouth while eating. Okay, ever done that? I'm sure you have. Okay. And then it says, and then he's angry with the person sitting next to him for no reason. Isn't it? I've done that before. Especially a father can vent his anger, or a husband can vent his anger at his poor wife or his children. They've done nothing wrong. He's bitten his tongue, or he's bitten the side of his mouth. Eat properly! You see? There is no connection between this person's action and my pain and my consequent anger. But something has happened that shouldn't have happened. I feel frustrated at being unable to control it. Anger is there, and I have to immediately discharge the anger. You see? Sometimes it's the cat that gets the anger. Sometimes before there were mobile phones, there used to be a thing called a public telephone box. I'm telling you because you're very young. But these public telephone boxes, believe it or not, you could make a telephone call in the middle of the street. And it was connected to a wire. Anyway, a lot of times they were made of glass. And on a Saturday morning, when I used to go for my japa walk in the neighborhood, often the public telephone box had been kicked and was lying in pieces. Why? Because some boy had telephoned his girl to find out why she didn't come and left him standing. And she said, "I know I'm no longer interested in you." And he'd put the phone down and become so angry that the anger had to be dissipated. It had to be discharged. What was the nearest thing handy? It was the telephone box made of glass. And then he would kick it and break it. Now, after a while, they started making these telephone boxes out of steel. But they were too dark, so they had to put a window that was super tough. So now, it doesn't happen. It just so happens that mobile phones are sometimes found in rivers. And he throws the mobile phone away. Okay? Or he then sends back a very, very angry text. You see? So anger must be discharged. Now sometimes it happens on the internet, doesn't it? Someone says something and immediately you write something back. Don't worry, we're going to be getting to pure devotional service in just a minute. Sometimes you have to immediately write something back, and you write something back very angrily. Now, one of the previous presidents of the United States of America, Abraham Lincoln, who was a very good peacemaker, he had a very good rule. He said that if you feel angry and you write a letter to express yourself, you should hold on to the letter for 3 days, and then you should send it. Now, I think this is a very important thing, because then when you read the letter, your emotions towards that person that you've written to have changed, you see, and then you can write in a more sober way. This was one of the advantages, my dear friends, of not having instant communication. Instant communication, yes, it has helped save many lives, but it's also helped destroy many lives and many relationships as well. Very instantly you can become angry with a person. Very instantly you can declare war. Very instantly you can let off an atomic bomb. And it's very dangerous when men who become angry or women who become angry are, you know, discharging their anger immediately through this. Anger must be controlled. Anger must be controlled. Please don't think that my anger is righteous anger, it's Vaishnav anger. Prabhupada would sometimes become angry like a lion. I'm a follower of Prabhupada. I can also become angry like a lion. Meow. That's how much your anger is there. You see? The point is that don't take upon yourself that privilege of righteous anger. You're not Hanuman. You see? You're just a person who's trying to be Das, 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 Das Anudas. Or as King Kulashekar said, Britya, 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 Brityanam. I'm the servant of the servant of my Lord's servant's servant's servant. Okay? And therefore, it's not in the position for servants to get so angry. You have to be very, very careful. One time, I told you the story before, I think, that one of our devotees went to have dinner with the Queen of England. This was just, you know, 2 years ago. It was a special invitation. So there was the Queen of England, her husband, and this devotee. That's all. Special invitation. Okay. And being the Queen of England, she doesn't change for anybody, but everybody else changes around her. That's the idea of being a queen. So we're hearing about kings and queens. You know the story of the king of Iran, the king of Persia, who came to London. I told you that story last time? No? Okay, he was here. He knows it. He remembers it. You know the story? That's right. He came. He was a guest of the king of England, the king at that time, many years ago. And he came with his retinue, his entourage. And he said they took him to the Tower of London. And they pointed to the place where in England where they used to cut the heads off the prisoners. You see? Here's justice for you. Here's justice. So he used to cut the heads off the prisoners. And he said, oh, very good. He said, we also sometimes doing this in Persia. I didn't know that you did it in England. Can you show me how you used to do it? In Persia, we used to do it with a big sword. Can you show me? He said, well, we used to do it with a big axe. He said, show me. Can you show me? He said, no, we don't do it anymore. We, the Tower of London is not used for these things. We hang people in a special jail and it's all, but they must be found guilty first. We don't just... He said, but no, you're the king. He said, you're the absolute monarch. He said, well, things have changed. Since 1642, when they cut the head off the King of England, things have changed. You see? We did it before France. The French had to wait till 1758, you see, to start the chopping business, but... So, since that time in England, we've had a constitutional monarch who does not have absolute power. So he said, no, he said, just, you can just kill one of your servants. He said, somebody unimportant. And he said, no, you see, we practice the principles of the Bible that everyone's equal. He said, no, that's not. He said, well, I don't practice that. He said, and he called one of his servants forward, and he said, put your head down there. He said, all right, now you can show me. And he was actually going to kill one of his own men on the spot, just because he wanted to see how... And the comment is that this is what king means. Absolute power. Absolute power. See, we've lost that concept. We're trying to regain that concept by coming in front of Krishna. This is what. But if you have a king with absolute power, it's very easy to understand Krishna. You see? And if you're punished sometimes, it's easy to understand that you are essentially a bad person and you have to work very hard to be a good person. Anyway, so here was a case where a devotee was with a person who pretty much has a position of, you know, absolute power. And because the queen has absolute power, she can eat what she likes. She can eat anything and does. And so they brought some what was it they brought for the devotee? They brought some fish or something like that. And so he what would he do? Here's a Vaishnav. He came from a South Indian Brahmin family, initiated in ISKCON, and they present him with a meat dish. And he just sort of looked, and he's sitting with the Queen of England. What would you do? Well, exactly what he did. He said, here's the Queen of England, but my master is higher than the Queen of England. There's the Queen of Vrindavan, Radharani herself. So I can't eat this. So he just sat there. And the husband of the queen said, Ramesh, he said, you're not eating your meal? He said, well, actually, I'm a vegetarian. He said, oh. He said, send off to the kitchen for some. And immediately they took it away. Servants came in, all nicely dressed, and came away. And immediately they started cooking something else, completely fresh, brought it. And it was some other type of seafood, some shelled fish or something like that. And he said, well, actually, no, I only eat vegetables. He said, really? Yes, that's what vegetarian means. And so anyway, they brought him something. And they were, although the prince and the queen, they didn't say sorry because they never apologized to anybody. That's the principle. If you're the king or the queen, you don't have to apologize to anybody. You only apologize to God and your priest. That's the thing. You don't apologize to any of your subjects. But an apology was issued by the kitchen, the queen's kitchen. Sorry, you told us that you were the head of a vegetarian organization, and we should have known better. And we get so used to cooking for different people. what can we do to make amends for something that we've done wrong? And he said, well, you can come to the Hare Krishna temple at Bhaktivedanta Manor, and we will serve you prasadam, food that's been offered to Krishna. He said, done. Very good. And so they came. There was 15 of them came. Everybody from the Queen's kitchen and the top lieutenant, who was in charge of the staff, the whole staff of Buckingham Palace, they came. And we gave them a tour of, we showed them, these are the cows, and these are the cows that we don't kill. I said, oh, really? You don't kill them? That's an interesting idea, isn't it? And then we served them prasadam. Now, I don't know if you know, but when they serve the food, they measure with a ruler the distance between the knife and the fork and the spoon and everything like this. They made a film of it that was shown on English television, how they measure everything. It's all very pucker, except what goes on the plate. So then we served them, but we wanted to show them that we were ecologically friendly and very environmentally aware. So we served them on the latest type of special potato starch plates and bowls. But we made the mistake of serving hot soup in a recyclable bowl. So halfway through the meal, the soup started to just ooze out of the bowl. Okay. Now, the thing you've got to understand is that these people are not royalty, and they don't consider themselves highly placed. They consider themselves as servants. So they were just able to have a joke about it, you see. Even though they're working in Buckingham Palace, they're just servants, you see. And we, before that, we were just telling each other stories, and they were saying, we said, living here at the temple means that when you wake up in the morning, there's only one thing on your mind: service to the divine couple. And they said, yes, we can understand that. Because when we wake up in the morning, there's only one thing on our minds: service, service, service. That's what we are, servants. And it's just the pleasure of the queen and her prince. So we can understand what you do. It was very interesting that we actually understood each other as servants. And so we swapped stories. Anyway, The point here is that they were coming on a special mission. And their special mission was on behalf of the Queen to express some regret and to some contrition that they'd made a great mistake. Because when you're the guest of the Queen, if the Queen's servants serve you abominable food that is not fit to be looked at, what to speak of touched, what to speak of eaten, food which is offensive, then it's considered that on behalf of the Queen, the servants have made an offense. You see? And so they came in a very humble mood to make an apology. So there was nothing that we could do that day that would have upset them. But now, it's very important in our devotional life that we express humility and regret for things that we may have done, that we do. Are we 10 minutes over already? We are, aren't we? And you will see in the writings of any Vaishnava Acharyas that as much as they glorify Krishna and say how much Krishna has filled their life with happiness, they're also discussing how much regret they have for something that they've done perhaps years and years and years in the past. Bhaktivinoda sings like that, Narottam Das Thakur sings like that. Wasted time, how I wasted my time not being Krishna conscious. Another aspect of this, which is sometimes forgotten by devotees, is that you're not just apologizing for offenses. Sometimes devotees don't adequately express a sense of regret at having done something which they consider to be an expression of righteous anger. So a devotee gets angry at someone, thinks that he's right, and dogged refusal not to ever say sorry about anything. But it can be something that's more moral than it is one of service. It can be an offense of omission rather than offense of commission. Some things that you do are wrong, and some things that you fail to do are wrong. There are cases where, for instance, a devotee has borrowed money from someone, but used the money in Krishna's service, and the money wasn't for him at all. It was something to serve Krishna. And then the devotee from whom he borrowed the money comes and says, "Can I have my money back?" And he becomes angry with that person. You see? And it was all for Krishna. I gave it to Krishna. Why are you angry that I used your money to serve Krishna? What's your problem, Prabhu? You know? In this case, regret is important. An expression of contrition is important. Yes, I should not have done that. But sometimes I see in our devotional situations, in our community situations, that devotees don't even know when something is wrong, according to Dharma. If you borrow money from someone, whatever they use it for, you see, you must repay it. Whatever you use it for, you must repay it. You see? Do you understand the difference? It's just like, yes, it's for Krishna, but it's not that Krishna and serving Krishna destroys Dharma between human beings. Rather, Krishna is the giver of Dharma. You see? This is the point, that Krishna gives Dharma. And therefore, Dharma must be enshrined in a devotee community. Otherwise, you have chaos. And you will have war. And you will have different groups of devotees, either not understanding other groups of devotees. And you'll have a situation where you have internal tension and strife, because no one knows who's right and who's wrong. It's interesting, isn't it? At least I find it interesting. You know, a sannyasi marries his female disciple. What is supposed to happen in those circumstances? What is the correct expression of regret, remorse, contrition? And what is the punishment for such a person? We were discussing this last night. What is the punishment? We don't have any punishment except forgiveness. We forgive everybody, everything. But Prabhupada said, he told that story of the boy that was always forgiven by his mother. Do you remember that story? The boy that was never, ever punished for anything by his mother. And eventually he became a criminal. And one day he was caught, and he was in the court, and the judge sentenced him to death. And his mother was beside herself with grief, and the boy turned to his mother and said, "Come, I have some last words that I want to speak to you." And his mother came over, and he leaned forward. This is a true story, apparently. True story. And he leaned over to his mother, and he bit a piece of her ear off. And she said, "What was that for? Why did you do that? I've always loved you." He said, "Yes, you've always loved me, but you never punished me. And therefore, I didn't know right from wrong. And now we'll look what you've done. Now look at how my life has turned out." So forgiveness is very important. Mercy, compassion, all that is very important. And sometimes we see Prabhupada in very testing situations would offer the hand of compassion to his wayward disciples. But at the same time, it is very difficult to organize any type of society, even a religious spiritual society, unless there is justice. There must be justice, and there must be expressions of regret, and there must be a penalty also. It must be a punishment. And so in this situation, we see two things going on. One, we see a normal situation between a husband and wife, king and his queen. He's done something wrong. He now realizes what he's done wrong. That's the first step, to realize what you've done wrong. Second is to apologize. And then the third step is to accept some punishment for it, meted out by the person who to whom you've done that wrong. You see, how can I repay you? What can I do? You see. So we're seeing that, and from that, Prabhupada is drawing this conclusion also that for many, many lifetimes we've even denied the existence of Krishna. But Krishna has never given up on us, even though we've given up on him. For many, many lifetimes, the super soul, Paramatma, has accompanied the individual soul on the journey. And we have been atheists, we've been agnostics, we've been great Pashandis, great meat eaters, great offenders. But still, Krishna has forgiven us to the point where... Actually, we've been punished as well. This is the thing. We've been punished by forgetfulness. So the thing is that Krishna is all... There's mercy running as a thread. But in order to help us, we've gone through many great periods of pain. So regret is the expression of a voluntary acceptance of pain and a loss of prestige, a loss of power, in order to appease that person that who we've offended. And that's what we do when we become devotees. You see? Like this young man here. He has a beautiful head of hair. He's only how old? How old are you? 19. He was letting it grow, and I said, "Prabhuji, brahmachari, hair." So he said, "All right, okay." See, now he has beautiful head. Prabhupada would say this is a beautiful head. Shining head. Why shouldn't he grow his hair? You see? Because for many, 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 many lifetimes he had beautiful hair, but what good did it do him? So in this lifetime, it only caused him to make sinful actions. So in this lifetime, he said, "Okay, this is a sacrifice." You see? For many, many lifetimes, we've worn beautiful jewelry. Now the jewelry that we wear on our heads is a picture of someone's feet. And that really makes you look like a servant. In India, the word das sometimes is not translated as servant. Sometimes it's translated as slave. You've become a slave. You see? We become Krishna's slaves. And we're always talking about the feet, the feet, the feet, the feet, the holy feet, the sacred feet, the lotus feet. You see? You see? The beautiful, fragrant feet. I bow down at the feet. It's all about the feet. In The next verse tomorrow, it's he touches the feet of his wife. Every day we touch the feet of Prabhupada, we offer flowers to his feet. When we wake up Krishna in the morning, it's the feet, the feet, the feet. My head, Krishna's feet. That means a slave. That's slavery. Divine slavery. You see? But this is to make up, that's one aspect of it. Yes, it's training us to love Krishna, but one aspect is to make up for every single time in a previous life when you have put yourself above God. In this life, never again will I put myself above God. You see? My wardrobe, see? My beautiful clothing, you see, my hairstyle, you see? Even my face. My face has been disfigured by a permanent clay tattoo. Every day I put this clay tattoo on my face to remind myself, in a previous life, I was a very proud person, and now I have to become a slave in order to make up for it. Of course, usually there's different reasons that we think that we do it. That's all right, but just concentrating on this. So in this life, I very much regret what I've done in previous lifetimes. And it's good sometimes to remember what you did in this lifetime and the billions of sinful activities that we performed. You see? And how much pain we gave to Lord Krishna. So with this always in mind, a regretful servant, a contrite servant, is always a person who finds it easy to be a servant. As soon as you start thinking, as Gurudas Prabhu, who started our yatra in London, I was traveling with him in 1976, and he'd just come from being Prabhupada's 1975, he'd just come from being Prabhupada's servant in Vrindavan. And he said, you know what Prabhupada told me last week? He said that we are so conceited, we're always thinking that we are the master. He said that when somebody calls you Prabhu, immediately you think, yes, I am. Now come and clean my shoes. He said, this is the thought. When someone calls you Prabhu, I said, yes. Would you like to clean my shoes? So when the servant forgets that he's a servant and becomes the master, that's when anger arises. You should have done this for me. You should have said this to me. You should have provided this for me. You should have offered me respect. Why have you not shown me enough respect? You see? This is where anger comes. Don't you know that the ideas that I have are better than your ideas? Therefore, when you have an idea that's different from mine, I become angry. I become frustrated. My sense of who I am, everybody carries with them an image of who they are. And when that becomes frustrated, I may become angry. But the difficult thing is that anger, when discharged against the Vaishnavas, is like a mad elephant that's been drinking alcohol. You see? And runs into the garden and destroys all the plants. It's very, very difficult. So we need to take the tongue, put it between the teeth, keep it there. We may think something about a Vaishnav, but we have to be very careful not to express it. You see? All right. Hare Krishna. And thank you for kindly allowing me to go way over time. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.